Welcome to episode 161 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Dancy Clare, and my guest of the podcast is Jess Montgomery, whose The Widows was recently published. I don't know about you, but I love to be on the spot when a series starts. The Widows takes place in the Appalachian area of Ohio in the 1920s and features Lily Ross, Ohio's first female sheriff. Not so fantastical, by the way, as Lily is broadly based on a woman named Maud Collins, who was indeed the first female sheriff in Ohio in the mid-1920s. Here's Jess Montgomery to talk about The Widows. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I'm very excited to have Jess Montgomery on the podcast today to talk about her debut novel, The Widows. Welcome, Jess.
Thank you so much.
There are so many interesting aspects of The Widows, it's hard to know where to start. So I'm going to pick the time period of the 1920s. I know why it fascinates me, but this is your interview. What pointed you towards setting this book, and probably a new series, I'm hoping, in 1920s Appalachian region of Ohio?
Well, for the 1920s, it was sort of built into where I got the idea. I was researching places to take our younger daughter hiking in southeastern Ohio. She's a graduate of Ohio U and was attending Ohio U at the time. And I ran across a website for a county near her county that featured Maud Collins, the true first female sheriff in Ohio in 1925. And so just the fact that there would have been a female sheriff that long ago, and by the way, the next documented female sheriff in Ohio was in 1976. So that kind of added to the fascination. I very much wanted to explore what it would have been like to have been a female sheriff in rural Appalachia in 1925. So that's where I got the year and somewhat the place. But my family of origin is from Appalachia in eastern Kentucky, both sides going back as far as anybody can document. I'm the first-generation Buckeye, which is the nickname for an Ohioan, and my family never let me forget it. So I'm well steeped in Appalachian culture, and I just had never really explored that aspect of my own life and identity in my writing, and so it became kind of an opportunity to explore that as well.
Well, it's interesting that you mention Appalachia. There's a lot of not a lot, but more interest lately with Vance's book and then the reply book of set of essays. And I read a lot of Julia Keller, who blurbed your book, and also David Joy. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, doesn't make me an expert, but it's made me much more aware of the uniqueness of the region and the people that lived there and moved there from other countries. And you also touch on that, the idea of immigration. We're not getting into the book right away, but since you mentioned it, the idea that people emigrated to this region mostly from Europe, and the reaction of native-born people to these people. And we should mention these were all from Europe, like places, pretty non-controversial places like Liechtenstein and Lithuania. So I'm of Lithuanian descent. So I found this really, really interesting.
In researching this book, I spent a lot of time in southeastern Ohio. I live outside of the Appalachian area of Ohio. But I spent a lot of time over there, and mostly, you know, partly as a way to visit my daughter and call it book research, but also because my family were all tobacco farmers, and then when they migrated north, they became factory workers. So I'm well aware of those backgrounds of labor, but I only had a few uncles and great uncles who worked as coal miners, so I didn't know that part of labor history very well, and I wanted to make sure I got it right. In one of my trips over there, I spent time with a couple of retired coal miners, and they talked about it, and it was fascinating to me that you know, they met people from all kinds of countries as they, you know, kind of moved in to fill these jobs, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, and that there was a tradition in their coal mining town that, you know, when it was lunchtime, you just went to, you know, and you were a kid and you weren't in school, you just went to whichever person's house happened to be open, and that mom fed you. And your mom fed whatever kid showed up at her house. And so they would meet people from all kinds of backgrounds that weren't like theirs. And they said when they went into the army to fight in Korea, the Korean military action, as we call it, that they found that they were more worldly about meeting people from other cultures than even some folks from less rural areas would have been, just because they got used to, well, this person's from Germany or Lithuania or wherever, which I found really fascinating.
And maybe a lesson for the rest of us, although I do try to keep Speaking of Mysteries a non-political place. Back to the book. Lily's husband, Lily Ross, who is your protagonist, the first female sheriff in Ohio. Mm-hmm. Her husband had been the sheriff of Bronwyn County, which I should mention is a fictional county.
Yes.
He's killed, and she's asked to step in as the temporary sheriff. Mm-hmm. In your acknowledgments, you mention how a story sometimes comes to a writer, and you touched on this in our first question, as opposed to a writer conjuring a story, is what I think of it as. And tell us a little bit more about this Maud, who was the first sheriff of in Ohio, the first female sheriff.
Right. So her husband, in real life, she was older than my Lily by probably 8 or so years. They had 5 children, which I tried to have more than 2 children for Lily and couldn't handle it even on the page. So... I have 2 children in real life, so I thought, fine, Lily, you can handle 2 children and on my page. But Maud had 5, Maud and Fletcher. And, he was the sheriff. They lived in the sheriff's house. There was a jailhouse behind the sheriff's house. And he was killed in the line of duty. There was no mystery about it whatsoever. He was serving a warrant. She saw the assault take place. She had to bear witness in court and testify against his murderer. And then she was packing up to take her 5 children with her back to West Virginia when the county commissioner showed up and said, "Where are you going, Maud? We want you to fill in." And so she filled in for the remainder of Fletcher's term. And then in 1926, and I find this so utterly fascinating, she ran in her own right and won by a landslide. What? That's just amazing to me. And of course, Lily is a fictional character. She's inspired by Maud. But I was just fascinated by this young woman in that era dealing, I mean, in any era, it would be challenging, but dealing with that back then and taking it in stride. And as I researched, I found pictures of Maud. She solved a murder. She busted up stills. There's a picture of her busting up a still with her little daughter, who's like maybe 6, standing next to her. And everybody else in the picture, you know, are men. And there she is, like, well, you know, it was take your daughter to work day back in 1928 or whatever. I joke, but I mean, it would be hard to find child care now for a mother of 5 who's a sheriff. What's more back then? So I was just really fascinated by her. And honestly, the photo I ran across of her, she looks both so tender and so tough. And some things were going on with my family of origin on my mother's side with my mother that I was very unhappy about how my mother was being treated. And so I felt angry at some family members on that side. And so I kind of felt like, well, you know, there's some folks who could use shooting, but I might go to jail for that, and I don't have a gun. So instead, I'll write this novel inspired by Maud. And what was interesting for me was that as I wrote, and Lily is dealing with this horrible loss, because she doesn't know who killed her husband in my story, and she's bent on vengeance. And that's how I started writing her. But as time went on, as I wrote, and, you know, you've read the novel, so you know, she has to balance her own personal sense of loss with what's right for the greater community and her family. So it was very cathartic for me on a personal level to write the book.
Well, you also weave two of the most significant legal changes of the 20th century into this book, and that's women winning the right to vote in national elections. I should mention that because there were some states that permitted women to vote. And the passage of the Volstead Act, which is also known as Prohibition. Mm-hmm. So in your book, these are both key elements. I would imagine, as you said, in Maud's life, as in Lily, your character's life, these are two competing forces. I would say especially the Volstead Act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting to start. So when I research historically, I like to start very broad and then narrow down. And I don't like to write even the most remote rural areas as living in a vacuum, because they don't. They're affected as much as anybody by the greater social movements and political movements that are sweeping the world or the nation around them. And one reason women pushed for the right to vote was they also, many of those same women wanted prohibition. So the two movements were intertwined, but in a very complicated way. And it was interesting to research this and realize that, which, I mean, I knew, but just to read nuanced articles about it, that it's not like, oh, women got the right to vote and everybody was fine with it. Not true.
No, not true at all.
Yeah, right. And it's not like, oh, prohibition happened and nobody drank. Well, of course not. We all know how, you know, that worked out. So it was interesting to try to look at the nuanced ways people might respond to these two major events, the conflict individuals might feel. You know, Lily's kind of, she's liberated, but she's not a feminist the way we would be now. So how she has to, like, navigate that path in the 20s in a rural area
And in your book, she's in favor of prohibition.
Yes. Actually, she turns the other eye to bootlegging. Yeah. Because she recognizes the realities of, you know, she's one sheriff, and it was her husband's attitude as well, with a couple deputies here and there, and it's really hard to traverse those areas, so you have to focus where you're going to put your attention. So,
and I also think she had a reality check as to the economic. She had a reality check in two areas, the economic impact on the people that manufactured moonshine or had distilleries in their backyards or hidden in caves, and also the opportunity for the growth of organized crime in the wake of the Volstead Act, in the wake of Prohibition, how it just opened up this the genie was out of the bottle.
Yeah, it was a real opportunity for organized crime, definitely. Yeah, and wasted so much time and effort, really, and generated more crime than it prevented.
Well, there are those that say that it completely cemented organized crime into the lifeblood of the United States. You know, what had been sort of localized protection rackets and, other sins, prostitution, just became like a multinational corporation, you know, with cooperation among gangs, and just, you know, because they were fulfilling a need. It's, I mean, a lot smarter people than me, more knowledgeable people than me have weighed in. So I'm going to, but I think that, I don't think it's a stretch to say that.
I don't either. And I think it was interesting to try to weave those elements in, hopefully in a subtle kind of, I mean, you know, the novel's not about prohibition, but it's certainly a factor in the choices that Lily has to make and what she has to deal with. So,
and I don't think you can talk about America in the 20s without prohibition, you know, finding a way into the story. It was a profound reckoning for the United States. And so was the other thing that I thought was interesting about your book, and this is, I'm just fascinated by this, so you're going to have to put up with my hobby horse, is in the wake of World War I, which in the 20s was still referred to as the Great War, it cast a long shadow on the story, and you mentioned that the men of the region who went to war were more worldly in their way because they had encountered people from other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But the men who had gone abroad to see things, you know, the horrors of war, but also the cities of Europe. Mm-hmm. And there was so much revolutionary thought in the air, and it moved across the ocean to the United States. And your characters, I thought, represented the struggle to digest all of these changes. The mm-hmm. growth of the labor movement, which is a huge part of the book. Mm-hmm. Women getting the right to vote. Prohibition and just the impact of this horrible war on the men who fought it. So did you do a lot of research to have all of these elements come together, or because of your background and your family, was it easy? You know, it's like a lot to stuff into a small package, and I thought you did it really, really well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So my father, who passed away this past fall, fought in World War II. And he was a BAR man in the Army. So his life expectancy on the front line was, you know, a couple of minutes. but he managed to survive, thank the good Lord. And he was part of the first wave that was to invade Normandy, but fortunately he got the mumps, and so he was delayed by a week, and caught up with what remained of his unit, and then, you know, fought his way through with everybody else through France and into Germany, liberated a small internment camp, and when my dad was in his 80s, he decided that we should go, he was 88 actually, that we should go to Normandy with a small group and retrace where he'd fought. And I said, okay, sure. So off we went to Normandy and retraced as much as we could where he had fought. And it was just interesting to hear him at 88 kind of open up about the emotions that he'd carried his whole life. So, you know, he was like 21 when the war ended, 21, 22. And he talked about it occasionally, but he really opened up about, you know, now we would call it PTSD, but then we didn't. And so when I was writing this book, I started thinking about, well, that would be true for any war, you know. So how did this ripple forward for these men? Even though it was a different war, but it would have had the same effect. So I wanted to kind of include that. And I do think things, you know, just ripple forward for decades. It's not as if an event happens and then, well, we kind of get over it and it doesn't impact the rest, you know, of our lives if it's a major event. Think of 9/11, of course. You know, my kids were, my older daughter was coming of age when 9/11 happened, and it's definitely shaped her life. Even though we're in the middle of Ohio, you know, far away from New York City. So I kind of wanted to explore those themes.
And of course, what I found interesting was all of these young men and some young women, but mostly young men from the United States went to Europe and they came back. And there were these societal forces that had not gone to war that sort of wanted everything to go back to normal and back to that sort of Victorian restriction. And that was over.
Yeah.
And it caused a great deal of turmoil. And one of the things that had been imported from Europe all the way from Russia, and as it made its way across Europe, England, Ireland, was the idea of the organization of labor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that, you have miners. There's a mine in Rossville, Lily Ross, that's a whole thing, also lives in Kinship.
Right.
But you have this labor organization, and I think that sometimes it gets lost. I mean, now that the unions are there, they're not as strong as they once were, but they're still there and they're accepted. United Mine Workers, United Auto Workers, Teamsters, these, you know. But in the 20s, this was a very, very tough thing for mostly men, but as you've got Marvina, there were women that were active in labor organization.
Oh, yeah.
And they really, truly put their lives on the line mm-hmm. to better the working conditions in the United States, in industry.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring that up, because Marvina is spiritually sort of inspired by Mother Jones. Again, I'm not writing about Mother Jones, but that's sort of Marvina's, you know, character in her own right, but that organizing work and attitude definitely pulled from that. But again, referencing my father, he was a union guy and a union organizer himself. And so I grew up in a household, you know, he'd been a tobacco farmer, then he went and fought in the war. Then he came back and he was a tobacco farmer again for a while. Then he, like I said, you know, people came up here to work in factories. So he was very pro-union. I mean, you know, we could debate religion, we could debate politics, but we could not debate the importance and value of a union. And, you know, I get it. There, you know, people will say to me who don't have that background, well, but unions do things that are wrong and there's abuse. And I'm like, yes, yes. And in every organization, that is true. But I'm very pro-union. And there's a scene in the novel where Marvina is speechifying about all these horrid things that have, you know, she's referencing events that these men would have known about union busting and worker abuse, and they're all absolutely 100% true. I mean, that page and a half is absolutely true. And one of the things I reference is the Battle for Blair Mountain, which was the second largest uprising in the U.S. Of citizens other than the Civil War. And, you know, it was truly a war in which our government fired on our own people, and hundreds of miners, you know, and a few people fighting against them. But the government definitely, and the hired hands of the Pinkertons, definitely had the upper hand. And, you know, so hundreds of men were killed, thousands were put in prison, and it nearly broke the back of the United Mine Workers. And it's interesting to me that this book has been out for a little while, people from the coal mining or Appalachian community have, you know, several have reached out to me and said, thank you. Thank you for capturing this, and thank you for doing it in a respectful way. And then other folks who aren't from those backgrounds say, well, this is great. This is really a fascinating read, but of course you've exaggerated. They would never have put young boys in mines, right? Oh, yes. Yes, of course they did, you know, especially in the 1920s. I mean, not now, but back then. So it's been interesting to see this difference of reaction, either thank you or surprise. So.
And we can't talk about the widows without talking about women. And I'm going to go back to the genie coming out of the bottle illusion. During the war, women had done a multitude of things that their men folk usually did. You know, in World War II, we had Rosie the Riveter, but it also happened in World War I.
Oh, yeah.
And then once the war is over, men and society in general want everything to go back to normal. And Lily and Marvina are examples of women who had to take control of their lives. And 100 years later, that seems to still be controversial. I mean, you don't have to weigh in on you know, the challenges women, although we are speaking on International Women's Day.
Oh, yes,
that in spite of the fact that it was so new and novel to have a sheriff in a female sheriff in 1925, the next one didn't come along for 50 years. So I don't think you were heavy-handed in the book, but it must have been part of the equation in putting these characters together.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I define a feminist as anyone who thinks that women and men should, you know, be treated as equal humans, not, you know, women are better than men or men are terrible, but that men and women are human beings and thus should be treated equally. And this seems like such a basic concept to me, but it's amazing how there are still so many gender differences. You know, when our kids were little and I would go to, and they're grown now, but I would have a business event that I would need to go to. I remember the first time, and then it would happen repeatedly, I would be shocked. The people would say to me, oh, so your husband's babysitting. How nice of him to babysit. And I'd say, no, he's parenting. He's not babysitting. And my daughters work in fields. I think every field has, you know, almost every field has women in those fields now. So, but they're working in fields that are not traditionally female fields. And so they, you know, in 2019, 2018 last year, you know, several years before, have run into just comments about, you know, well, you're a woman and you're majoring in math. How did that happen? You know, and it just still strikes me as, really? So, yeah, there was definitely a sense of, you know, I wanted to honor the times and the characters and how they would have actually lived in the time and place in which they lived. But to show, yeah, there were definitely struggles just simply for being female. And I wanted to honor, you know, I reference at the back of my book, in my acknowledgments, my Aunt Opal, my father's sister, she also grew up in eastern Kentucky and, you know, rural America, and but went on to get a PhD and worked, you know, in the 1970s in the Carter administration. So she was a definite trailblazer in her own right, as well as my Aunt Mary, who worked, you know, on engineering. Excuse me, the bug is getting to me today. Engineering telephone lines in rural areas. So I've definitely got these role models that I drew from my own life, but also for these women in my book.
And I'd like to mention that the contrast between Marvina and Lily, aside from the fact that they both had a relationship with Lily's husband, Daniel, Marvina sort of came up hard, and she's illiterate. And that's another thing that in the 1920s, illiteracy was not uncommon. Education was hard to come by. And it's not a reflection of intelligence, because she certainly was smart. She was very, very smart. And savvy in a lot of what they call emotional intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
In reading a crowd. So I thought that without belaboring it, once again, you brought that to the fore. And I think that's another thing that might be shocking to the readers of this book.
Right. So, you know, Lily is a high school graduate, which sounds like okay. But, you know, she would have been a high school graduate more in the 19-teens. So that's unusual, you know? That's especially for a woman, even in not necessarily particularly rural areas. Marvina didn't have access to a public school. There wasn't that requirement that we have now that, you know, every child should, and that hopefully we'll keep having, that every child should have the right to a public education and have that ability. And so how do you how do you educate yourself if you're in a very rural area and you don't know what you don't know and you don't know where to find that information and get that help? So, yeah, she is very emotionally and socially savvy because she's a survivor, and she has to be. So she's super smart. She just hasn't been given the same opportunities. And it's fascinating that they're in the same county and yet from worlds apart in many ways. But I know that is true to the area because it's hard to navigate very hilly and mountainous areas, especially 100 years ago.
And, you know, I hinted at this question before, and this is my last question. I'm hoping that we're going to see Lily Ross and Marvina Whitcomb in subsequent novels because they are a dynamic duo.
Well, thank you. Yes, I'm working on the next book that hopefully will come out next year. It's called The Hollows, and it's set about a year and a half later. And, yeah, I'll catch up with them and their adventures at that point.
Well, Jess, thank you so much for joining us on Speaking of Mysteries and talking about The Widows and giving us hope for the next novel, that it will be out soon, because they are really an engaging, Lily is an engaging person. And, of course, as sheriff, she can investigate crimes, so we can have procedurals, historical procedurals, which are, you know, a favorite of mine and many others.
Oh, thank you so much.